Morning, Your Honors. It's my pleasure to introduce my co-counsel in this matter, Irving Bazar, who has been previously admitted and who will make the argument on behalf of the plaintiff, appellant herein, Frank Seinfeld. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. The fundamental issue before this court is what showing a shareholder must make who meets all of the statutory requirements of Section 220 and seeks to ascertain if mismanagement has occurred, a conceded proper purpose, and a legitimate concern of the shareholder in order to have a limited inspection of certain books and records of that corporation relative to his concern and his view. There are numerous cases that equate the showing to evidence, and the shareholder's obligation to show by a preponderance of evidence that there is a possibility of wrongdoing. Indeed, the decision below and appellee's brief and supplemental briefs constantly harp on the theme that the plaintiff failed to have any evidence of wrongdoing and plaintiff's concession of the absence of such evidence. We submit that if evidence is required in the case of a public company, that requirement is effectively a non-starter and reads into Section 220 a requirement that is entirely difficult, if not impossible, for a shareholder of a public company. Indeed, no shareholder of a public company can have any evidence absent a whistleblower, a secret video cassette, or some publicity reflecting either prior false press releases and subsequent public announcements that show those press releases might have been untrue, governmental suits or investigations, or securities fraud class actions.
If the standard's not going to be evidence, how is a publicly traded company with millions of shareholders ever going to do any productive business if millions and millions of shareholders can simply request production of documents?
The answer to that is, I submit, Your Honor, is that it has to be a legitimate concern, firstly. You have to have some specific allegations, some specific showing based upon public filings that suggests that there is a concern. That's step one. Step two is, consider the fact that a shareholder, and my client in particular in this case, owns about 4,000 shares individually, and his wife owns 2,000 more, has gone to some no small amount of expense in mounting this Section 220 application. So I would submit to Your Honor that I would suggest that numerous cases are not going to be brought by shareholders anxious to march through corporate records to see if there's something wrong. There has to be something specifically addressed in public filings that would suggest that there may be something to focus on.
All right, so that's going to be the standard. Public filings, not newspaper articles. You want to move away from evidence and have us announce a rule that's related to public filings.
I would submit that it has to be public filings unless the public publicity releases reflect something so outrageously false on its face that you could, in fact, suggest that that too is a basis for legitimate concern.
Can you explain to me why that's different than some evidence? What would you find in the public filings that would not rise to the level of being characterized as some evidence of wrongdoing?
I guess, Your Honor, the issue is what is the meaning of the word evidence? In our case, we looked at and alleged that there in this company involved Verizon had three chief executive officers, whatever their titles were, that had received compensation over a three-year period of something like $206 million, the bulk of which came in stock option grants. It came about as a result of the original employment contracts called for no such grants, came about as a result of amendments shortly before the shareholders approved this plan by which stock options could be given. And lo and behold, at a time when the price of the stock was falling, they were getting $206 million. Now, my brother Welsh argues, and the court below made reference to the fact, that that's based on valuations. And let me go to that issue immediately. In the first place, we didn't produce any expert that valued these options. What we did was we took the factors listed by Verizon in its public filings, in its 10-Ks, as it was required to do under FASB 25 and I think SEC rules as well, and simply multiply those numbers out. Verizon didn't do it, we did it. And the only reason we had Hammerslaw do it was because my partner Gershon didn't know how to do the arithmetic, and Hammerslaw has a computer program, you plug the numbers in and the numbers come out. That's it. There was no valuation. They also argue, if it please the court, that somehow the options are now underwater. Well, these options weren't underwater when they were granted. The board had to have evaluated it, and then those numbers have never been disclosed by Verizon. And it is a well-known fact that options have value even underwater because they're given over a period of time. And while they may be momentarily now underwater, over time they may not be underwater, and they may well come back to where they were and then some.
I may have misinterpreted the thrust of Justice Holland's questions, but my thinking is that he, like I, and perhaps others, if we're going to change the standard for access to 220 information, to what do we change it and why? Just step away for a minute. We have a good understanding of your facts and what you had available to the trial court to support your request. But whether it's some evidence or some other standard that you're suggesting ought to apply, tell us what it should be and why. Beyond going to a public filings and finding something, what is that something that we're supposed to find?
Let me first go back to the question of evidence, which, if I may, Your Honor, because this court didn't point to evidence in the Disney case in Brehm. You said go look at public filings and make an appropriate application with rifled precision. I submit that what you have to have is some specific transaction or activity reflected in the public documents which on its face would suggest that it needs inquiry, some concern by a shareholder, why did this occur? And it isn't just an issue of judgment. There's always some dispute about judgment. Indeed, in the Security First case, that started off as a fight over judgment, a 5% shareholder didn't like the fact that a merger had been canceled. And so I think it has to be, if you can demonstrate, as it were, that there is some question about transactions, and in the murky area of compensation particularly, where you don't know what the board is looking at, I would submit that a shareholder says, look at these numbers. The numbers are high. They, under the original contracts, clearly under public filings supported by the documents, they didn't have such a right. How could they get this right now? What did the board look at? Did it cross the T's, dot the I's, run the numbers? And if that is done, then the shareholder has no basis for claiming that there's something wrong. You can't have a requirement of evidence in this case, if it please, Your Honor. Supposing we had come in with an expert at the 220 hearing. Impeccable credentials, impeccable, did all evaluations, binomial theorems, and came up with a compensation valuation of $206 million, $400 million. And my brother Welsh comes in with another expert of equally strong credentials, impeccable credentials, did his mathematics, his binomial theories, and the compensation is $6 million. Is Section 220 to become the battleground from what was once a derivative action, now the 220 action, which is supposed to be a summary proceeding where the plaintiff, the petitioner, has no discovery rights, to become a battleground to establish that some wrong took place, or the possibility of some wrong took place. We submit the rational basis question is the appropriate standard. Namely, have you alleged with specific allegations, specific references to public filings, public documents that would suggest there is something wrong, the possibility of something wrong, and that the owner of the business after all, a shareholder is a part owner of it, ought to be entitled to ask on a limited basis to look at some limited records. I might add, Verizon never contested the limited inspection we sought in the sense that they would argue that these documents were too broad, too much, too whatever.
Let's suppose that we don't change the standard under Section 220, that it remains the standard that's articulated in Thomas and Betts and in the Security First case. What's left of your appeal?
We would argue that we showed the appropriate showing, as it were, by showing that on the public documents there was a question of how this compensation came to be awarded. And indeed, curiously, my adversary tries to argue that they did disclose the valuation. They put that in their supplemental reply brief. It was never argued below. Indeed, when the vice chancellor asked him, what valuation did you put on the options, he was unable to provide it. And the main of the first argument in this case, when Justice Berger asked him what valuation, he was unable to provide it. Somehow they fitted it in the reply. And let me tell you that what they did there was simply multiply the number of options by the option exercise price. That's not what the SEC said that you should do. And I might add that that's not what they do in their financial statements. They do indicate the factors you're supposed to use to get into the valuation.
Well, the case that you're relying upon, that is that you contend was made under the existing standard, is that three CEOs, if that's what they were, received a high number collectively for compensation, higher than what was authorized in the face of the original contracts, that is, employment agreements. I understand, however, that those employment agreements were amended and that that amendment was disclosed.
The amendments may have been disclosed, Your Honor, but the fact of the matter is we need to know why these were amended to enable them to participate in the plan, which was just coming into being as well. In other words, they weren't amended way back when, so, and said provided there in those plans that you participate in existing plans. We might think, if I were a bit paranoid, that maybe the amendments took place because they were going to put this start shareholder plan into being, and they were going to get all these extra stock options valued at a very significant number as part of the compensation. And we, as a shareholder, should be entitled to know what and why this occurred and how did they value that. What did these three executive officers do that justified the awards?
Right, but the case that you originally cited to us is satisfying the test under Thomas versus Betts, or Thomas and Betts, was the high compensation, much lower ceiling, or lower ceiling, under the original contracts. Then, when it turns out that the contracts were amended and the amendment was disclosed, you change your position.
No, Your Honor,
saying,
I haven't
well,
checked.
Now there's a question of why they amended. What is it? Does your whole case under the Thomas and Betts Security First criterion amount to questions?
Let me, if I may, address Thomas Betts, if I may, because sometimes hard cases make hard law.
I'm familiar with the case.
Thomas Betts, if you will recall, Your Honor, involved what I would say as a backdrop, a question of the good faith of the petitioner. Thomas Betts bought into a wholly owned family business, bought the stock, I'm trying to remember, bought its interest from either the son-in-law or the nephew of the founder, and began to try to leverage that position pursuant to threats it had made. So I think the court might very well say, in that context, perhaps you have to do more.
Well,
but
in the Thomas and Betts case, the Supreme Court articulated a standard of what must be shown in order to establish a proper purpose to investigate mismanagement. Security First reaffirmed that standard, and that's all I'm talking about. I'm not sure the facts of Thomas and Betts make a difference.
But I would have to believe that, Your Honor, that you affirmed the decision and articulated the standard based on the record that appeared before the court at the time. And if the record is, I think if you read it, you will see that that is what happened in Thomas Betts. And I would submit that if you're going to have that standard for a public shareholder in a public company, that you make it impossible for 220 ever to be used effectively. Unless,
I'm just asking whether, in your case, the standard can be satisfied.
I would submit, A, it's satisfied and should be satisfied, and if you're going to change it to the rational basis, which is what is articulated in the question. Namely, that if it's a rational basis, we have it supported by specific allegations dovetailed into the particular documents, that should be enough to enable us to have a very limited inspection to see if, in fact, that occurred.
One last question. Is it correct that under the credible evidence to infer mismanagement, that your case amounts to a question as to whether or not the motive for amending the compensation agreements was well-intended or not?
No, I think it's also that goes to that and includes also how did you arrive at, assuming it was amended to enable them to participate, what did they do to justify that participation? I think that's a fair question. That should be a proper question for a shareholder to ask.
I'm getting confused, frankly, because I thought that the basis for your 220 request was the combination of the fact that three people instead of one were holding the position that you claim is effectively the same position, and that those three people, based upon your calculation, whatever way it was done, I don't really care about that, but that three people instead of one were holding the position of CEO, and that their combined salary and stock options was an excessive amount.
That is our position, yes, and it also came about as an additional factor, the fact that they got it on the eve, as it were, of the implementation of a stockholder-approved option plan whereby they'd be able to share, so they were amended. The original agreements didn't call for that at all. Those were two elements of our case.
Did you want to save the... I'm sorry.
I just wanted to follow up on one thing. That, if a stockholder is going to be given potentially greater access under 220, shouldn't the stockholder also have a greater responsibility, if you will, so that, for example, before you get to pursue your claim or your interest in finding out about potential mismanagement relating to the salaries, you would have to check out equivalent companies and see what the combined salaries of the top three officers of those companies are and be able to say to the court, look, this is way out of line. Look at these other 10 companies. That's enough to give us some support for our concern.
You asked me that in substance the last time, Your Honor, and I answered, as follows. A, you can't compare apples and oranges. Each company manufactures and sells a different kind of product, occupies a different segment of the market. So to compare compensation with one company to another, I think, is unfair. I think, for example, could these people get $206 million if they never showed up a day in there on the job and phoned it in from their yachts in the Caribbean? The fact that they only got $206 million while others are getting $500 million should not be the appropriate standard.
And all I'm trying to suggest and ask for your thinking on is whether there should be some requirement that the stockholder do basically as much as he or she can before invading the boardroom and getting documents. So if there's other information out there that goes to your concerns, that you would have some obligation to gather that together and present it to the court that, you know, this is how much I could find on my own. Now, you know, this gives me a basis for asking for more information directly from the company.
Assuming that that is an obligation you wish to impose on the shareholder, what would you do when the defendant, in this case Verizon, puts in an answer that says, we've compared it with 10 other companies, and those 10 other companies, the compensation is 50 times more than what we're paying our people. Does that end the case? Does that end our right to see whether this was fairly arrived at? Just to inspect a very limited number of documents?
You're not answering my question.
No, I thought I was. The answer is I think what we have to do is to give us what we have compared with what we could get. I don't know that a comparison in this case would serve the purpose, but I think we did allege specifically what happened, key to whatever public documents were available. I think that should be enough to enable us to have this very limited inspection.
Did you want to save the balance of your time?
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, I'm Edward Welsh from Skadden Arps. I appear on behalf of the appellee Verizon. Three of the characteristics of Delaware corporation law, which I think have contributed enormously to its success, are predictability, stability, and balance. Nowhere else on the planet offers the wealth of case law and the wealth of stability, predictability, and balance that's offered under Delaware's law. The law should be predictable. That enables good decision-making by Delaware corporate directors. That's why so many companies choose Delaware. Corporations on the NASDAQ, corporations on the New York Stock Exchange, corporations that are public, corporations that are private, a vast number of companies pick Delaware. That's why they copy our case law. That's why they copy our statutory law. People are watching, and people obviously watch this court. The law ought to be characterized not only by predictability, but it ought to be characterized by stability as well. It shouldn't change unnecessarily, unless, of course, there's a powerful reason to do it. Stare decisis, that's the heart of our common law and of our case law. That's worked for hundreds of years. That's what stability is about. The law also ought to be carefully balanced. It ought to take into account, of course, the interests of stockholders. It ought to take into account the interests of corporations as well. All three of those characteristics are represented in this court's construction of Section 220. What the plaintiffs ask your honors to do today is to go back to the 19th century. They've got a case. It's the Hewler case. At 1885, out of New Jersey, they found one. And what they want you to do in the third millennium is to go back to the 19th century. That's a terrible idea. I think, respectfully, that our competition in all sorts of states across the country that look to Delaware, to look to this court's decisions and look to our statutes, would be elated. The interpretations that this court has placed in 220 have been sound. Our case law has been sound. It's been developed over decades. Reflects all of these considerations, stability, predictability, and balance. Again, that's why corporations are choosing to come to our state.
Well, Mr. Welsh,
yes, sir.
I think we understand all that, and despite for some of us the attractiveness of going back to the 19th century. What we're talking about here, aren't we, is whether or not under the facts of this case and in the current environment, that mix of considerations for Delaware corporate law always has to be examined in light of the facts of the case. And the plaintiffs or appellants are suggesting, at least in my mind, that the balance that you refer to is currently out of whack, that the way in which the law was applied in this case and perhaps the way in which the standard is set generally has a balance so shifted in favor of the corporations that we've made access by way of 220 to information essential to shareholders. Asserting accountability of directors is imbalanced to the degree they have no right at all. So can you address whether on the facts of this case the standard as it's currently understood has been met by the plaintiff or not, and then the plaintiff's contention that we ought to go to a rational basis standard away from a credible evidence standard?
Sure, certainly, Your Honor. The Court of Chancery has held for decades that the credible basis standard is the correct interpretation. This court, as your honors know, in Thomas and Betts and Security First held the same thing. Case after case after case applies that rational basis standard pardon me, the credible basis standard. My apologies.
Incredible basis or credible evidence?
Your Honor, what has to be provided is some evidence to support a credible basis that some wrongdoing may have occurred. Thomas and Betts, as well as Security First, say that. Now, again, case after case.
That doesn't have to be admissible evidence.
Well, Your Honor, there is the issue, I recognize, with respect to hearsay, but I think some admissibility element certainly appears in the cases. There are cases that do rule on hearsay objections and that sort of thing. There are cases that don't, depending upon the circumstances. Chancery has some flexibility in dealing with that. So I would respond that way. The point I would make, though, is that these plaintiffs have only cited one case where documents have been denied flat out to a plaintiff stockholder. This case. That's it. Now, there's another one out there. The Mathis case does the same thing. But if you look to footnote 9 in our supplemental brief, we point out that just in the last few years, in the last 6 years alone, there have been 14 cases decided by the Court of Chancery which have ordered production of documents under Section 220 using that same standard that this Court has approved in Thomas and Betts as well as in Security First.
But that could mean that counsel are advising stockholders you can't sue, so don't.
I'm not going to speculate to that effect, Your Honor, but that's an awful lot of cases. The last case that came out of the Court of Chancery, Niagara Steel, hot off the presses, awarded documents to a stockholder looking for inspection. I don't think there's any basis whatsoever to conclude that counsel are telling stockholders don't proceed to exercise your rights under 220. The fact is the number of cases under 220 is extraordinary. They can cite one. This case. Now, we happen to know there's another one as well where inspection was denied. Well, but think of the hundreds and hundreds of cases. Yes, Madam Justice Berger.
Doesn't that suggest that maybe this case was wrongly decided?
Well, not at all, Your Honor. Mr. Justice Steele, the Chief Justice, asked me to talk about the facts, and if I could turn to that for a second. Right. This case was not wrongfully decided. The facts of this case are extraordinary. Let me take just a moment on that. Plaintiff wants to investigate disloyalty, waste, self-dealing, mismanagement. Mr. Justice Ridgely, you asked him at the last argument, what was the case really about? It's about waste, he said. Okay, what's the waste? All three CEOs simultaneously served, he says, as CEO, all three individuals. They received excess compensation, and they were granted unauthorized stock options. If you look at the briefs and the deposition, not one fact supports those conclusions. Let me just take briefly the points that we've tried to cover on that. Verizon never had three CEOs. The plaintiff admitted it in his deposition. They had two for a short period of time after the extraordinary large merger between Bell Atlantic and GTE in 2000. Very short period of time. And he acknowledged to me when I asked him, didn't that make sense from a board judgment standpoint? You're trying to coordinate two huge technology companies. He said yes. So there never were three CEOs, not coming from me, coming from the plaintiff. The executives did not perform duplicative work. He admitted that. There was no reason, he admitted, to challenge the decision of this board of directors to have two CEOs after that extraordinarily complex merger. He couldn't explain, even in the most rudimentary fashion, who calculated this $205 million number that he so frequently relies upon. He didn't know who calculated. He didn't know how it was calculated. And when I asked him about it, he acknowledged to me that every one of those numbers could be wrong. He didn't know. It was in his affidavit. And indeed, Vice Chancellor Lamb pointed out, even in the affidavit of Mr. Gershon, his lawyer, that they throw in to try to rehabilitate, pardon me, what the plaintiff had done, he didn't say who Mr. Hammerschlaw was, how he calculated, what he did, where the analysis came from, or anything else. But the record doesn't stop there. Again, they don't know how the numbers were calculated. The possibility exists that every one of those numbers is wrong. He admitted he had no reason to believe that whatever the number was, that the individuals that he's investigating didn't earn the benefits. They earned it. I asked him, do you have any reason, any facts at all, that would suggest that they didn't earn it fair and square? He said no, he didn't. I asked him about this question of entitlement to stock options. He admitted, when we went through the contracts and through the long-term incentive plan, which, by the way, was approved by stockholders, he admitted it. The contracts called for awarding stock options in minimum amounts. It could be more than a given number. It was a board judgment. He told us he had no basis for quarreling with the board's judgment. No basis, by the way, to believe that the long-term incentive compensation plan was amended in some way to benefit these executives. No facts on that. We asked about your Honor's question, Mr. Justice Ridgely, about waste. I asked him about that. Any basis for finding waste? No facts supporting waste. What about gain from the options? They received some stock options. Did they get any gain from those options? Well, the fact of the matter is he had no basis for thinking that they did. And the TUI affidavit that was submitted points out very clearly all those options were underwater. They never got any benefit from them. Now, what about corporate process? That's something that's been a powerful interest of this court. What about corporate process? Well, he told me in the deposition, no claim of conflict of interest whatsoever, no independence issue with respect to these directors, and he was not challenging the process through which corporate decisions were made with respect to compensation, these options, or anything else. He wasn't challenging those points.
Well, let me interrupt you, because the way you're presenting it sounds impressive as to the absence of any basis for any thoughts that the plaintiff might have had. But we all know that what this is all about is that plaintiff is looking for documents and plaintiff doesn't have anything but the small amount of information that started this all. So if you say, you know, do you have a basis to believe that the process was inappropriate? No, I've got nothing. Do you have a basis to believe that it was this? No, I've got nothing, because all they've got is that three people, and as I understand it, they didn't say three people were CEOs at the same time. They said that three people were serving in essentially the same capacity at the same time, and that the amount that they were receiving was excessive and had substantially increased as a result of these stock options from what their unamended contracts would have allowed. Now, I'm not saying that that gives them documents, but is it really fair to say that they have nothing? You know, they have some facts. The facts may turn out to be wrong, but at this point, they've got some facts, don't they?
Respectfully, Your Honor, they don't have one fact, not even one. If you look at the record, again, if you click through the key points, what we did in taking this deposition was look to Thomas and Betts and look to Security First. We were looking for some evidence. You can look through their briefs, and as we point out in our supplemental brief, not one fact. He disclaimed every fact that he put forth in his affidavit, and indeed the affidavit of his counsel, except to the extent that he didn't know what had happened and wasn't able to say anything about what had occurred with respect to that valuation analysis, a point that was not lost on the Vice Chancellor. Your Honor?
Okay, well, wait a second.
Yes, ma'am.
All right. Let's make it real simple. There is an allegation that three people at Verizon received the equivalent of $206 million in stock options, right?
It's more precisely, it's in compensation.
Compensation.
There is a mere allegation to that effect.
Okay. And the factual support for that was that somebody did some math and multiplied number of stock options granted by the price at which they could be exercised, somebody did some calculation.
Did something. I would agree with that, Your Honor.
Okay, but
we don't know what it was.
But the thing is, they didn't just make this up whole cloth. They came up with a concern based upon their calculation, based upon what was public information. Why should that not be enough to say, okay, well, we're with you so far. You've alleged, for purposes of books and records, you've alleged something that happened and your reason for being concerned about what happened.
Respectfully, Your Honor, to answer that question, I don't know that they didn't make it up out of whole cloth. There's nothing in this record which suggests that they didn't. Remember, I asked him, how did they come up with these numbers?
Well, and the affidavit of counsel explains that.
But it doesn't, Your Honor. Respectfully, it does not. All it says is we ran some numbers and came up with another number. As the Vice Chancellor pointed out, we don't know who this guy is. We don't know if he's credentialed or if he's not. We don't know what his inputs were. We don't know what he used in terms of exercise price, what assumptions he made about when the exercise was going to occur,
right,
or anything else.
Let's assume,
we know nothing about him.
Let's assume for the moment that all of that was factually supported. You know, whether you agree with it or not, somebody who has credentials and who wasn't just doing hocus pocus came up with this number. Now would you agree that they have alleged something that warrants some consideration in terms of books and records?
I would not, Your Honor. I think that's a wholly different case than what we have here, dramatically different case. So I'd want to be cautious about what I said about a different case than the one I'm arguing. But as Your Honor pointed out in the last argument, even if you accept his numbers, you're talking three individuals over 3 years. And the number that was used by them in their brief, and I think by Your Honor in the last argument, was maybe that you could argue, I think without any factual support, that it was $20 million a year per person. If you wanted to do some kind of analysis, again, that is utterly unsupported, would I concede that that shows wrongdoing? Absolutely not. I wouldn't concede for an instant that this court ought to endorse a rule that says simply because an executive made $20 million from some of the biggest, most powerful, most successful, most beneficial corporations in the country and indeed the world, does that suggest that the company's books and records ought to be turned over, made available just because of a number? Well, I wouldn't suggest that for a minute, Your Honor.
I may misunderstand the facts or misunderstand the way in which they were presented by your opponent. But is it simply the mere suggestion that you have three members of management, whether they have coextensive jobs or not, who are under contract, and then suddenly, without any explanation of the basis for amending the contract, the contracts are amended to allow them to participate in a profit-sharing plan that is potentially geared to increase their compensation, and company performance at the same time doesn't reflect any additional award of compensation in any form to the people that are managing the company? Because while they're getting they're subject to a suggested process that results in an increase in their compensation, shareholder value is not rising. So is it irrational for a shareholder to want to know what was the standard that the board addressed in terms of increasing the compensation of these three people in any way at that particular period of time?
Your Honor, respectfully, I think that assumption that you heard about a bit from counsel today is flat wrong. That the contracts were amended to allow participation in stock options. Again, if we look at the record, that's not what the record shows. That's why this record is so incredibly important.
Well, that's why I started with the caveat that I may have the facts wrong.
Yes,
that's the way they were presented, as I understand.
I heard that today, too, and, Your Honor, I didn't know what he was talking about because I took the deposition of the plaintiff. We talked about Mr. Seidenberg's 2000 contract. We talked about his earlier contract. The plaintiff acknowledged to me that he was entitled to options under all these contracts. Go back as far as you want with respect to what's in the record.
The availability of the options, in fact, was not additional compensation.
No, sir. He was entitled to, if you look at we go through a series in his deposition of contracts. This is something that's just being said without any support in the record. If you look at his deposition, we analyzed each one of Mr. Seidenberg's, Mr. Babio's, and Mr. Lee's contracts. I went over all of them with him, and I said, see where it says in this contract and in the earlier ones that these gentlemen were entitled to stock options. They were entitled to long-term compensation. The suggestion that something was amended here, again, the vice chancellor dealt with that as well. He said there's no basis for that. There's nothing in the record to support that. This plaintiff doesn't say what was amended. They don't say how it was amended. They don't cite to a single section of a document being amended to support that conclusory claim that Your Honor's heard about this morning. This record is extraordinary. If there is to be an effect test stare decisis, this is the case where it ought to be applied. And, you know, over the last few years, there have been from time to time amendments to the corporation law and indeed to Section 220. For 30 years, that standard has been in place in Chancery and been applied. For 10 years, it's been applied by this court. The legislature hasn't touched that. There is no evidence of any unfairness or any inequity in the standard that this court has previously, in Thomas and Betts, refused to amend. Even when you decided the Rails Brothers case and you said we're going to insist that you use the tools at hand under Section 220 to look into issues before you file cases, derivative cases. The court went on to say, we do not intend to eviscerate that standard. Why? Because of balance. It is so important to protect corporations. Let me turn to that, if I could, for just a moment. A rational basis standard here would be unwarranted and it would be totally unworkable. First of all, what would a rational basis standard be? Well, if you look at what the Vice Chancellor said about this plaintiff, he offers you two things, curiosity and speculation, based upon his deposition, based upon his affidavits. And, oh, by the way, he has said in his affidavit and in his papers, I have nothing more to add at trial, nothing. He offers curiosity, and he offers speculation, and that's it. Now, would it be rational to allow stockholders to look into something if they're just curious about it? I suppose it might be. Would it be destructive of corporate interests? Absolutely, it would be. Without any evidence, there's no way to protect Delaware corporations from harmful fishing expeditions. Case after case by this court, including Thomas and Betts and Security First, say, we're not going to allow that. Why? Balance. It's balance. Now,
again, I may be misunderstanding your opponent's argument, but
yes, sir, Your
the
Honor.
Suggestion that by referring the public documents that are on file, it sounds to me like you could characterize their argument as saying, if one can draw a rational inference from those public documents, and then document the reference to the public documents and articulate that rational inference, and it suggests mismanagement or a failure of process, that let's not characterize it momentarily as curiosity, but it's a legitimate interest on the part of a shareholder to inquire into the basis for that rational inference. And a limited access to information may suggest to the shareholder that's now an irrational inference, or it may suggest it's rational, it's documented, and they can move forward by filing a derivative complaint. The extent to which this court seems to want from time to time to send cases back and say, you should have gone to a 220 action, that has to be a meaningful exercise. We can't assume sending people to a 220 action is sending them into a bottomless pit.
Well, absolutely. Understood, Your Honor. So that makes sense. That makes sense. There are cases where plaintiffs have gone to the public record, gone to public documents, put together a case, pointed out that there were some red flags. We cite them in our brief. There were some red flags that appeared in the public documents. No problem there.
As I understand your position, public documents could constitute circumstantial evidence. And you could apply the current standard using the public documents to assemble the circumstantial evidence you need to establish a credible basis.
Well, that's been done, Your Honor. I would agree with that. I mean, certainly a 10-K, a 10-Q, an annual report, those are public documents. That's evidence. If there's something wrong, the question is, do you have evidence of what? Of some wrongful conduct. If they can put together a case from the public documents, and they didn't do it because they didn't cite any public documents. He keeps talking to you about public documents, but they didn't cite any. The only public documents that were put in the record were put in the record by Verizon. We took him through, when trying to figure out what his credible basis was, we took him through the public records, and we said, here's the contracts. Here's what's disclosed. There's been huge disclosure about compensation.
Well,
it was all there.
We're trying to sort out how the present standard works and how the proposed standard would work.
Yes, sir.
But I just wanted to make sure that I understood your briefs, and as I understand all of your briefs, you agree that public documents could constitute circumstantial evidence. It's just that in this case, they never marshaled a circumstantial evidence case from the public documents.
Well, they never cited any public documents, Your Honor. That's correct. I would agree with that analysis. Indeed, we cite a case in our brief where if you spot red flags in public documents, K's, Q's, annual reports, whatever they are, 8-Ks, that's a legitimate thing to bring to the court's attention. No problem there, but it has to be credible evidence of some wrongful action. They haven't done it here. And what he's asking you to do with this rational basis standard is impose huge costs on Delaware corporations, major disruption on Delaware corporations. He wants you to go back to the 19th century. In the Hewler case he relies upon, there were 300 shares issued and outstanding. Plaintiff had 67. Verizon has more than 2 billion shares outstanding. Going back to the 19th century by the great state of Delaware is not the way to go. I do believe that our competition would be elated to see that Delaware took a step back like that. That Delaware exposed its corporations to constant harassment, to huge costs, in the face of a standard that was workable, that was effective, that has done the job for Delaware corporations now for three decades.
In terms of your parade of horribles, is it realistic to expect that any of the millions of small stockholders are going to go to the expense and effort to do a 220 proceeding just because they're curious or you know, just to harass a corporation?
Your Honor, we know that there is an industry out there, the sole function of which is to look at press releases and 8Ks and to file cases. That's a healthy system. That works. This court has endorsed this system in a lot of different ways, but it's got to be balanced. And to say, just because someone has some rational thought, that they like to inquire into something, why? Because they're curious and because they have a speculative concern, that's not balanced. That is absolutely not balanced. It happened here. Your Honor inquires, is it something we can expect stockholders to do? It happened. But the Vice Chancellor found. On this record, they had nothing but curiosity and speculation. So again, I go back to my point. Without evidence, there is no way to protect the corporation from frivolous demands, from harassment. With evidence, and indeed it might be, as Mr. Justice Holland suggests, it may well be something that's taken out of a public filing. I have no problem with that. Public filings were used all the time. Indeed, in the Niagara Steel case, public filings were used to achieve a result, at least in part, that the plaintiff wanted.
Thank you, Mr. Welch.
Yes, sir, Your Honor.
Let me briefly comment on several things said by my brother Welch. In the first place, we are not seeking all the books and records. It's a very limited scope that we seek, very limited records. Secondly, I believe he's unfairly quoted from the deposition of my client. I think you have to read the entire deposition to get the full picture of what the client was speaking about. It is true he conceded the contracts permitted, the amended contracts permitted the grant of these options. What is also equally true is that Sachs against Brady long ago held that there are limits even under equity when there are no benchmarks, as these contracts had no benchmarks. Lastly, all the cases cited by my brother Welch about how they give 220 are basically cases involving not public companies, but small companies, privately held, in which are different dynamics are involved. And clearly, the right to 220 inspection should be even more granted than it should be in other kinds of situations. But in a public company, how can a shareholder have evidence except by public filings? We looked at the public filings. We quoted from that. We even told him how we did the calculations referring to the public filings. If Mr. Welch had any question that we used the wrong factors, that we made up the factors, he could have done those numbers and said, you're wrong. It's not $206 million. It's only $75 million. Here is page 2, 3, 5 of the 10-K. He didn't do it. And so we submit that the order below should be reversed. And we ought to have the right based on our limited, legitimate concern. I don't believe shareholders are going to come in and trampling public companies. There's a very big expense involved in this kind of a proceeding. My client has borne it. I don't think everyone's rushing in immediately. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. We'll recess and take the case under advisement.